Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is walking into the 12th canto of Purgatorio. We're on the Terrace of Pride, we're past the Gate of Purgatorio, we've passed all the souls that are on the rings, slopes, what are they? Before the major gate of Purgatorio itself, seems like some of them are roads around the mountain, and some of them seem to just be rest stops under rocks. Just kind of open spaces like that Veil of the Kings below the Gate of Purgatory. Anyway, we're above all of that. And we're up on the Terrace of Pride, the first of the terraces of this giant mountain that arises in the Antipodes on the other side of the globe from Italy. If that doesn't make sense, oh my gosh, you got to go back to Inferno and catch up. But otherwise, we're here at my English translation of Canto 12, lines 13 through 24. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. And most importantly there, you can talk to me about this episode and we can continue the conversation. I appreciate all the DMs on social media about these episodes, and I appreciate the commentary on my website because it helps others to see what you're thinking. Let's just get to it. Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 13 through 24. Virgil said to me, "Turn your eyes down below. It'll be good for you. It'll smooth out our path to see the roadbed beneath the soles of our feet. As tombs in the ground are full of signs to explain what the dead once were and make memory present again, making us grieve once more, full of tears at the prodding of remembrance, its spurs driven into the sides of our sorrowing, so I saw these figures carved here, better in their appearance thanks to the craft, along that path made into the side of the mountain." This is a tough passage, and it's why I wanted to break the introductory 24 lines of Canto 12 into two parts, because that metaphor that makes up the last nine lines, simile, but in metaphoric space that makes up the last nine lines, well, that is a corker. I am sure I'm going to trip all over myself when we get to it. Let's just start with the first three lines, which are probably easier. Virgil said to me, "Turn your eyes down below. It'll be good for you. It'll smooth out our path to see the road bed beneath the soles of our feet." And I think that this is important to see here because we're about to hit this really rough simile that's about to come. Not rough in its craft, but rough in its meaning. And Virgil right here seems to call us back to, realism. If I want to get fancy, I'm going to say he calls us back to mimesis. Or if I want to get fancy, I'm going to say he's going to call us back to verisimilitude. Virgil makes this call to pay attention to what's under our feet, or the pilgrim to pay attention to what's under his feet as they walk along on this terrace. And it's interesting that in the last passage in this introductory bit, in the last passage in the last episode of this podcast, Virgil had made a Ulyssian declaration telling Dante to basically make his oars wings and fly off into this unknown journey that is comedy, crazy. And now Virgil's advice is not so heady and not so poetic and not so, dare we say, damning, but instead is a call to, hey, pay attention to what is. Now, here's what's weird about that. This is not what is. This is what is in the poem. But you can't think for a minute that this is what is, except you do. We all think for a moment, oh, Dante's got to look down at the road. Then we have to step back and say, oh, wait, what road? What mountain? What purgatory? Where are we? This is all imagined landscape. That quibble is warranted based on that dreaded simile that lies right in front of us. As tombs in the ground are full of signs, that's our first stop, the medieval Florentine word segnato. This word is interesting because it brings up the whole question of the making of symbolic meaning, signs, and certainly in tombs, and think about Dante's day, the tombs would be, in, let's say, in the floor of a church, in the walls too. But let's say in this case, we're looking at the tombs on the floor of a church. There are signs carved into it to say, well, this is a doctor, or this is a lawyer. This was the rector of the cathedral. This was a vicar. You know, there were signs to say who these people are, or notations. I'm laughing because when I was 19, I was traveling around England, and I went to Winchester to see the cathedral and also to do some walking out in the English countryside. I wanted to find the tomb of Jane Austen. I couldn't find it anywhere, and I asked one of the docents there, you know, who, like a typical 19-year-old idiot, where's the tomb of Jane Austen? And I'll never forget that he said to me, you're standing on it. And sure enough, there she was, right below me. So it's so ridiculous, but that's like this, right? There are tombs, and they've got various symbols, words, and the words are part of the symbols. They've got text, you know, something saying who this person was. And we should just see that. In other words, we're being led into a landscape in which symbolic words, images, all kinds of signs, to use the linguistic word, are used to make meaning. All right, going on, as tombs in the ground are full of signs to explain what the dead once were, yep. So not make them, but make their memory present again. That's important for what comes next. And we would agree. We would say that when you go to visit a tombstone, it makes the memories present again, not the person. How do I say? My husband goes about once a year to his father's grave. My husband's dad died when my husband was very young. And he goes to his dad's grave. It's about 3.5-4 hours from our house. And he wants to go about once a year and just sit at his dad's grave. And he sits and he talks to his dad and, you know, does what one does at graves. And I don't go with him because it's really important for him to have this private space with the memory of his father. But we wouldn't say that my husband's father is there with him, probably. It's the memory, just like it says here. The memory comes back once again, and you can kind of talk through those memories. Great. It goes on. The memory comes back again, making us grieve once more, full of tears at the prodding of remembrance. It spurs, and this idea of spurs being driven into the sides of sorrowing. I mean, this is now gotten very painful. The memory hurts. A lot of scholars miss this middle tercet of this very tough simile. And I think it's really important for us just to hang here for a second and look at it. The claim here is that signs cause the memory to come back, which then causes the feeling to come back. And I think that's really important for Dante. It is that feeling that he's going for. It's to get you to the place where you feel, because feelings are the basis of repentance, sorrowing, feeling bad. Repentance is not an intellectual game in Dante's world. It's a game of feeling. Let me explain this a different way. I just came out of teaching 8 weeks on Willa Cather, on the novels of Willa Cather. Cather has this claim in an essay once that a novel is not really about the events in the novel. It's about the thing not named. This is really tough, but the thing not named, and that a novel should evoke that so that at the end of it, a reader is left with this feeling of something that just is beyond meaning, and it should be a feeling, according to Cather, something that just escapes in front of you and is never actually named. That's kind of what's going on here. This idea that art is going to prompt you to feel something, that the symbolic landscape of the carvings, and we can't help but think of comedy, is going to cause you to feel something, because we're starting to enter the modern world with Dante. And repentance, conversion, is not going to be an intellectual exercise in a humanistic landscape. It's going to become more and more an exercise of the feelings. This is the landscape you and I live in. You can intellectualize it all you want, but you know that you and I live in a landscape in which the symbols are meant to provoke feelings, and they're already, in this case, bad feelings, sorrowing, and they're shoving, pricking, sticking the spurs into that wound to make a change. But now it gets weirder in the last three lines. The simile turns to its comparison, as this, so this. Let me go back and read the whole thing one more time. As tombs in the ground are full of signs to explain what the dead once were and make their memory present again, making us grieve once more, full of tears at the prodding of remembrance, its spurs driven into the sides of the sorrowing. So, I saw these figures carved here. We now will find out that they're in the ground. Thus, Virgil saying, look down at the ground beneath your feet. So I saw these figures carved here, better in their appearance thanks to the craft along the path made into the side of the mountain. That word craft is the real stick. In the medieval Florentine, it's artificio, or some scholars would say you pronounce it in the medieval Florentine, artificio. It depends on how you see the medieval Florentine pronounced, which no one can actually answer. This word is very odd. It does mean craft or craftsmanship, but it's already starting to carry the notion of artifice, of facade. Not quite artificial, don't go that far in English, but think about artifice, facade, the thing in front, the mask. This is another of these hepex legomenons. Hepex is the only time a word is used in comedy. This is a very wild word because it relates to the craft of art. I want to go back to that little bit with so, and I just want to kind of translate it for you actually. But here's what it would look like if I just did it. Word for word, something like this. So I saw there, but of a better resemblance in the crafted version, figures which were made in the road going around the mountain. We know that God carves this stuff. We knew this from the intaglio. So this is God's art, and it must be what God has put into the paving stones, into the pavement of the road around Mount Purgatory. So it's God's art. Allegedly, here's the claim, though, and it gets weirder, that you can be realer than the original. I love this because it's so silly. You can be realer than the original. And we saw this with the intaglios. When we got to Trajan and the widow, I mean, the whole thing dissolved into a big dramatic conversation. The thing itself on the marble relief at the side of the mountain became realer than the actual conversation. And so what the claim here is that they're better in this second artifice. Somehow they're realer than real, or they're better than the original, which means, and this is where it gets wild, that art can surpass nature. But I thought we learned back in Inferno that art was nature's child and nature was God's child. But what if art can surpass nature, the historical reality, the actuality of what happened? It surpasses it. And so God's art certainly surpasses its historical reality. I mean, that's the easy way around the claim. Well, God's art surpasses the historical reality of what we're about to see, because what we're about to see is a whole set, a giant list of figures carved to represent the sin of pride. Okay, great. God's art surpasses its historical reality. It's better, in fact, clearer. It's clearer in its representation than it was when it actually happened. Great, fine. The problem is it's not God's art. It's Dante's art. Dante's the one who's creating these things. So the claim here is that the art of comedy is better than the original. Oh my gosh, just think about this for a minute. On the Terrace of Pride, Dante's got this problem. That is, he's making this claim that art can surpass reality, that what he's doing is better than when it actually happened, which seems like a pretty pride-filled claim. You got to get to a really wild spot to claim that your art is better than the original. Now listen, there's always a problem here with trying to represent what is, because if in your art, your painting, your sculpture, your poetry, you try to represent what is, eventually you do have to come to the notion that what you've represented actually is clearer than the original. I think of poetry, modern poetry. I don't know, Sharon Olds, Ellen Bass, great modern poets. I think about the way that they craft inner confessional reality. By the time they're done crafting it, I think they would probably claim that it's clearer in the poem than when it actually happens. Ellen Bass has this great poem, Indigo, about passing a man jogging on the street, and he's all tattooed, and, tattooed from neck down to ankles, and he's pushing a baby stroller, and he's running along, and this thing devolves into this really unbelievably melancholic reality in which the poet says, you know, I'm just so jealous. I wish I'd married a man like that. I wish I married a man who wanted to be in his body, wanted to be in his body so badly that he marked it up and underlined it. And it goes on, and I wish my daughter had had a dad like that. And she develops this entire imaginative landscape for this tattooed guy running. I think that Bass's claim would be that in the poem, it's clearer than when it actually happened, if indeed it ever actually happened. And that is certainly the position of art. The problem is here, we're dealing with God's art and a representation allegedly of the art God made. And so it's starting to take on the resonances of overreach, of Ulyssesian insanity here, of going places you shouldn't go because you're making this claim that what's here is realer than real. It's better than the first time around. Well, and you can say, well, because God made it. But God didn't make it. You, poet, made it. Think about photographs for a minute. It might be helpful to think about it this way. Photographs are mostly transitory images, right? You take a photograph at a birthday party, at an anniversary, a wedding, unless it's a staged photograph with a, you know, professional photographer, it's mostly transitory. I would say that most of the photographs in your albums or on your computer or on your phone are transitory. Oh, this is something I ate in a restaurant. This is a beautiful vista I saw. That kind of thing. You know, passing. Sunset, looking out over the lake. I don't know. You shoot a shot and there it is. Go back to the photographs from your childhood. Photographs of birthdays and graduations. Are they posed? Some of them, yes. But they're still transitory. And even with a professional photographer, let's say at a wedding, they're still passing. You're not going to wear that wedding dress again. You're not going to maybe wear that tuxedo again. You're not going to be with those people again. And all kinds of things happen. I mean, I think Bruce's and my first non-legal wedding back in 1999, we sometimes look back at those pictures, staged pictures of a group of, I think, 30 people who gathered at an inn off the coast of Maine, and we had this non-legal, as we called it at the time, commitment ceremony. And we look back at those pictures and know that of the 30, six of them are dead now. And it has this very weird feeling that you're looking at something that's passed away. And here's the deal. Photographs are, at the moment, actually transitory. But as they sit there, the longer they sit, the meaning stabilizes. And they accrete meaning, and it stabilizes the transitory nature of the photograph. So when you look back at photographs of your childhood birthdays, those which were just, you know, mom or dad clicking off a photo of you blowing out the candles on your cake, it's now taken on a kind of solidity, a stability. It's gained meaning with the passing of time. And the photograph, here's the kick, has become realer than real. It's become clearer. At the moment when you blew out the candles on your cake, you weren't thinking, oh my gosh, to be this young and to have this cake and la, 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 and this party and whatever was happening. I don't know, name it. But now, farther away, you see it more clearly. Oh, to have been that young. Oh, wasn't that nice that mom made me that cake? Wasn't it nice that my friends were there? Or wasn't it nice that we went on vacation somewhere? Or we went on holiday somewhere? Or doesn't that be nice? Wasn't it terrible? Wasn't it horrible that mom was drunk at my birthday party? Or wasn't it horrible that at Christmas my parents always ended up fighting and ruining the whole thing? It stabilizes and gains meaning, and it no longer is the transitory experience. That's the claim here. that in fact what we're about to see were a set of actions and transitory experiences involving various historical, biblical, and classical figures. And in fact, when it was happening, it was passing by. But now God's art, which is Dante's art, has made it realer than real, has stabilized the meaning. That is the grandest claim you can make. Art stabilizes meaning. Art, which is by its very nature unstable meaning. Go to any museum, go to the Prado, go to the Met, go to, I don't know, your local art museum down the road, go any place and look at the art, and you'll know that art is destabilizing in its meaning, and yet the claim of art is that it stabilizes meaning. How can it be both at once? Dante's wrestling with it in this incredibly difficult simile at the opening of Canto 12. Before we get to the next segment of this podcast, let me say it would be great if you could rate this podcast or write a review. That would be even better. Even just great podcast does wonders. And in any language, on any platform, I know Spotify doesn't let you do this, but Apple Podcast does and Audible does. That would be terrific in terms of how you can help out with this podcast. But you know what? I'm just going to keep walking, and I'm loving it that you're here with me. So let's get going again. Let's read this whole thing again, right from the top. I'm going to read all of the opening of Canto 12 from line 1 all the way out to line 24, just to get the sweep of it. Paired up as bulls go along under a yoke, that belabored soul and I walked along, at least as long as my sweet tutor permitted it. But then Virgil said, "Leave him be and get going, because it's only right to speed your ship with wings and with oars as much as you can." I stood up, spine straightened, as a person should be, even though my thoughts remained bent over and emptied out. So I started off, willingly following in my master's footsteps. With our very movement, we passed on in a way that showed we were more fleet-footed. Virgil said to me, "Turn your eyes down below. It'll be good for you. It'll smooth out our path to see the roadbed beneath the soles of our feet. As tombs in the ground are full of signs to explain what the dead once were and make their memory present again, making us grieve once more, full of tears at the prodding of remembrance, its spurs driven into the sides of the sorrowing. So I saw these figures carved here, better in their appearance thanks to the craft, along that path made into the side of the mountain." Tough passage to translate, tough to get the complexity, the theoretical artistic complexity into the passage. I hope I wrestled some with it, and I hope I left more questions than actually I gave answers, because I think the passage is so elliptical because it's daring so much. We're going to pass on and see what's underneath the feet of the souls of our pilgrim. I will see you on the journey ahead as we look down at these carvings. Keep your shoes on. I'm Mark Scarborough, and let's keep walking.